That was Katie Melua with Fields of Gold. Now, Samantha Gowing is a Le Cordon Bleu teacher, a clinical nutritionist and author who's worked for more than 20 years with hotels, resorts, health retreats all over the world on improving their health and well-being. Rita Ehrlich talked with Sam about food as medicine and the apparent disconnect between restaurant food and nutrition.
I'm talking to Samantha Gowing, who's working on a course for online learning at Cordon Bleu School. And the course is about plant-based foods. Now, for her, and for all of us, I think, this is an ongoing part of learning in the hospitality industry. Sam, talk to us about plant-based diets.
Hi, Rita. Thank you so much for having me. You know, there's such a push towards eating more plants, and Michael Pollan, of course, famously said, not eat too much, eat mostly plants, essentially. And I think in the current era, we're all perhaps struggling to eat more healthily within reason, but the rise of plant-based eating is beyond roast vegetables and beautiful legume salads and so forth. It's actually looking at the variations of the plant-based meats, and there are the cultivated, cultured, or cell-based meats. And we perhaps can explore those areas a little later, but my complexities and my paradox or my in line of investigation is, do we really need to eat a plant-based version of something that animal farming and preferably regenerative farming has given us for quite some time in the form of a wonderful steak or a well-brought-up chook? So that started my inquiry.
Well, it's mine too, because one of the problems I have is, as it were, fake food, and to turn plant-based food into something that pretends to be meat seems to me to do both things a disservice.
Well, it's just such an extraordinary time that we're at, you know, and some of this plant-based meat is taken from animal cells and then grown on a scaffold in a laboratory, and there's a mimicry or a biomimicry that creates a plant-based version of that original animal cell that is then generated or cultivated or cultured depending on the process to create this essentially laboratory meat. And I've been very curious about this, Rita, because it's a long way from a lentil chickpea burger or veggie burger that I've never really been a huge fan of. But I have to say, when I was developing this course, I've eaten a lot more vegetarian food to see what's out there. And I must say from the outset that serve me up a beetroot, maybe chickpea or legume burger compared to something that has a textured vegetable protein quality or character to it, and I can assure you I'll go to the plant-based chickpea beetroot burger every time.
Thank you. I can believe that.
And now, I think you'll understand that. There's a Whole Foods and then there's this other variation.
Yes, that's right. Now, the burger is a really interesting one. And here I have to declare to listeners my interest in all of this. I've known Sam for many, many years. And when I knew her a lot, she and her brother were running a pub in Melbourne, a fabulous pub called The Grey Starling, which was named for the heroine of a shipwreck, who was also a racehorse. I mean, not the heroine of the shipwreck. The name was also given to a racehorse. And there were heaven knows there were burgers on the pub menu. But then, we're going back, 30 years, you were more likely to get a steak than a burger. So it seems to me that all food in restaurants and in pubs has changed a lot. Do you think it has?
I do, dramatically. And I still love, you know, the gastropubs as they grew up to be known. But I think you'll find that the consumer demand has become so great that alongside a classic beef burger or perhaps a cheeseburger or something like that, in a cafe or a bistro or a pub, you'll also find there is a push or a movement towards more plant-based options. Now, that might be a jackfruit curry, which can resemble the flavours or the texture, rather, sorry, the texture of pulled pork, believe it or not, or perhaps it's something that is more in the lines of this sort of textured vegetable protein, which were three words that I discovered way back in the 80s when I did some work with Virginia Hellier, of all people, and we did some menus for the sanitarium. I think it was a retreat, Rita, at Warburton Way.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
There, I can't remember the name of that, but textured vegetable protein was part of, you know, the vegan protein offer. And it's changed dramatically, but there's still essences of those trace proteins there as well.
Now, when you left the pub, you did a degree in nutrition. And you spent that, you were most interested at that stage in nutrition and health, as you still are. You spent a lot of time working on spa food, which is... How did that change for you?
I became really interested in some of the work that was coming out of California, and some of the chefs were doing beyond Nouvelle Cuisine, but they were doing healthy food in those luxurious spas that we would see from an Australian perspective, you know, in LA and so forth, and perhaps across America. But my concern was the food was minuscule and it was overly presented. Perhaps it was a little bit tricked up, even though perhaps the flavours were shortfall. And I realised there was a whole spa cuisine that I became really interested in. And I know that it didn't really have longer legs per se, but it did transpire to become a lot of the underpinning of the food of the health retreat industry, of which I've now worked for over 20 years. So what was called spa cuisine perhaps has given rise to different lighter style food that is now, or menus that are now offered in health retreats and luxury spas, as insofar as accommodation, not just where you go and have a facial, worldwide. And so that sort of variation made me very curious.
Yes, because my introduction to spa food looked as if it was going to, it was offering very thin people the chance to eat very little, prettily presented.
And you've always said that very beautifully, those very thin people. There's a quote I think I had in my first book from Raymond Blanc. Right, he was a great influence for me, and just the way he approached this whole cuisine. And as you say, you know, the market was essentially smaller people, perhaps, or petite people wanting to lose size, and that's often been the genre of many the health retreats in the past. But these days, when I moved to Byron Bay, Rita, in, let me see, 2008, I took up surfing, and I just found that there was a culture, or perhaps a way, or dare I call it a trend, for healthier food in health retreats worldwide with the addition of surfing. So I developed what I called my surf spa cuisine, or surf spa food, because I wanted to create healthy food that surfers could have after a surf, or to give them enough power to tackle those waves that would propel them into that journey. And it wasn't too delicate, but it was still honest and robust and authentic, a little bit like me.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because sometime in the 90s, I think, where was I? Somewhere in Queensland, where we went into a pretty ordinary cafe and the food was extraordinary. And I commented on some of the foods that were available for sale. And the owner of the place said, yeah, we get a lot of surfies in and they care about what they eat.
Isn't that interesting? Because I really noticed that, particularly when I relocated from Melbourne up to Byron Bay, that it wasn't for vanity and it wasn't for, you know, just because I was living in the Rainbow Region, as it used to be called here. It was more for energy and for surfability, for want of a better description, which I thought was lovely, that people were really interested in what they ate for performance.
Yeah. Now, your online learning, this is, how many courses have you given for Cordon Bleu?
I have presented at least four, if not five, four-week courses since 2019 in a course that I created or designed and deliver for Le Cordon Bleu called Gastronomy and Nutrition. And that course is really helping people who want to write cafe menus, for example, or cooks who want to write better recipes, or perhaps restaurateurs who want to move into the wellness arena. It helps them understand where they can and more specifically cannot claim or make claims around certain ingredients insofar as if they're good for one's health or not. So, for example, that turmeric latte, perhaps you cannot necessarily claim that that will be something that could help to prevent COVID-19, to put that into current context. There are lots of regulations worldwide that control how to make those claims. And so, thankfully, you need to be a qualified nutritionist, such as myself, or a variational in order to justify those claims.
Oh, good, because there have been some very, very strange claims over the years.
But kale is one of them, my friend.
Kale and quinoa, God bless us. what I'm really struck by gastronomy and nutrition, because until quite recently, they would have been polar opposites.
And isn't that the case, you know, as you well know, as my dear friend and colleague, at the end of the 90s when I retrained as a clinical nutritionist, people from the restaurant industry in particular, not your good self, said, I must be crazy. What has nutrition got to do with food and restaurants? And to this day, 20 years on, I'm still flabbergasted by the fact that we had a disconnect from the healing properties of our food as opposed to what we were serving up in, you know, no hat, one hat to three hat restaurants. And that has become my great mission, and positive and joyful mission in life.
Rita Ehrlich there in conversation with Samantha Gowing. For more information, go to www.foodhealthwealth.com.